We'll wrap up the quarter by studying the seven churches of Asia. So today, again, timeline, culture, and customs. We'll fly through the cultures and customs because it's the same. I mean, we're talking about the same period we did last week, so not a lot new there. Solomon's influence. I kind of want to start by looking at Solomon because a lot of what we see happening within Judah, in my opinion, is influenced by Solomon. And then, you know, of course, kings of Judah. And then we will look at Gedaliah, which technically is after the fall, but we'll talk about him this week or next week. I want to talk about him this week. So timeline, here's all the kings. We're starting out in 931 to 913 B.C. Zedekiah's date's wrong. That should be 597 to 586. I'm going to make a note of that and fix it. Okay, note made. Jehoiachin, 597 B.C. So that's really the time period that we're going to go through. So this is a lot of information to go through, but we're going to move through it pretty quickly. So cultures and customs, again, we know how they dressed. We talked about this last week. It's the fringed robes. It's the floppy hats. It's the boots that turn up. And that is not a Santa Claus fashion trend. That originated in the Middle East. Again, the literacy, that this means a lot to me. Just education is very important to my family. And so knowing that people were able to read during this time period, it's meaningful to me. It's impactful. But then when you start thinking about these scriptures that are written down, whether or not people had access to them, whether or not they could read them if they did have access to them, when you see that this alphabet was created, it was 22 letters, it was common in all the pottery and pictures and things that are recovered from this time period, that's an ample amount of evidence to know that the common person was literate. They could have read scripture. They could have known for themselves what was going on. They didn't necessarily have to depend upon some, you know, higher educated person to explain things to them. Which is all the more reason why we should be disappointed that even a lot of the common people just got swept up in all this idolatry. They would have known better. And then the occupations in Israel. And I mean, it's the same thing whether you're in Judah or you're in Israel. Israel as a whole, there's trading routes. They partner with the Phoenicians. All of these things are basically the same. And so let's get into Solomon's influence. And so in 1 Kings chapter 11, 1 through 13, I'm just going to read the first few verses for us this morning, but do read all of them because it goes through and God tells Solomon that he's going to take the kingdom away from him because of the bad decisions that he has made. But in verse 1, King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's wife, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart to other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. What's interesting is if you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 3, there is a statement made that when the people get into the land, they will want a king. And there is a warning given in verse 3. And in this verse, it says, the king should not marry many women because... I think I switched my reference around. I'm sorry. Deuteronomy 7:3 says, do not intermarry with them. That's right. I'm sorry. I had those verses switched around and I didn't look at them. So, Deuteronomy 7:3 talks about, do not intermarry with people in the land because they will lead your hearts astray. And specifically, if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 1, there is a list of all the different peoples who he's referring to when he says them. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 17, there's a statement made about when you get into the land, the people are going to want a king, and the king should not take many wives because they will lead his heart astray. And so there's two statements made that Solomon does not heed. In Deuteronomy 7:3, do not intermarry with these foreign women from these foreign nations, and then do not take many wives. And he does both of these things. And as a result of that, we have what happens in chapter 11 here, which is his heart is led astray, and he serves these foreign gods. Now, what I think is particularly interesting is this has an impact on his children and his grandchildren as well. When you go to 1 Kings chapter 14 and verse 21, we learn something about Rehoboam. In verse 21, Rehoboam, son of Solomon, was king of Judah. He was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem in the city of the Lord, and he was chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. His mother's name was Naamah, and she was an Ammonite. When you go back to chapter 11, and you read in verse 5, Solomon's heart was led astray. He followed after the Asherah, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. One of his wives was an Ammonite, led his heart astray to serve Molech, and wouldn't you know it, that his son Rehoboam came about from an Ammonite wife. And what does Rehoboam do when he is king? Is he a good king or is he a bad king? He did evil in the sight of the Lord. And one of the things that he does, and I think I've got that here, is Rehoboam basically creates his own priesthood. He has these golden calves, similarly to what's going on with Jeroboam. Let me go over to 2 Chronicles just to make sure I say things correctly. In 2 Chronicles chapter 11, and then in verse 15, he appointed his own priests. With the goat and calf idols he had made, those from every tribe of Israel set their hearts. Yeah, and they follow Levites and Jews. Yeah. Is there? Yeah. Just making sure this just sounds so much like Jeroboam. I'm like, oh, I want to make sure I didn't misread something here. Okay, thank you very much. I'm like, thank you, Jordan. I was like, I was pretty sure I was right when I put that down. But anyway, so he creates his own priesthood. And so we've got Solomon marrying a lot of women from different countries. There's an influence for his generation. But then he has a child who becomes the king. His mother is an Ammonite. And you've got to believe that that influence there is causing Rehoboam to do a lot of the things that he's done. And then you look at Abijah, who is Rehoboam's son. And in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 3, he also does not serve God with his whole heart. And so you have three generations of people: Solomon's generation, Rehoboam's generation, and Abijah's generation, who all go from serving God, you know, under David's kingdom, and then three consecutive generations of serving the idols. It is not until Asa becomes king that any of this stuff is tried to be, like, they try to address it. And so three consecutive generations, these things are happening. And I think it's just a warning to us. As we make decisions in our lives, they are not only impacting us, but they can impact our children, our grandchildren, on down the lines. We just got to be careful. Because we can see very clearly today that Solomon's influence was great and in a lot of ways really set the tone for ultimately what happens in 597, 586 BC. So with that, let's get into the kings of Judah. And we have Rehoboam. Now, I showed this slide last week. I just changed the title to Rehoboam. And so what we find out about Rehoboam is that he is also attacked by Shishak. And so this wall is a depiction of all of the different peoples that Shishak conquered while he was the king. And now I know we can't see it, so I wanted to get a picture that was a little better. So we'll see that in just a minute. But this is Shishak. That's what he looked like. I mean, well, he wasn't made of gold, but I mean, that's his face. I guess he had a beard like that. I envy people who can grow facial hair, and it just seems like all the Egyptians could get a real sweet goatee going. He has one. Anyway, here's what's interesting about this fact, though, that Shishak attacks Judah. In 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1, we've already read about it. We read that Solomon married many foreign wives besides Pharaoh's daughter. So somehow, some way, Solomon and the Pharaoh make a covenant. This is how things work back then. Is they make some kind of an agreement, some kind of alliance with each other. There's the marriage of a daughter. And so during Solomon's time, Egypt in Israel, Judah, they are kind of partners. They have an alliance together. But what ends up happening is, you know, Solomon passes away. There's a new king now, his Shishak. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 12, 1 through 12, when Rehoboam rebels against God and does a lot of these things that we've just read about, where he is establishing his own priesthood and they're worshiping after idols, going into chapter 12, God sends Shishak to punish Rehoboam. And so after Rehoboam's position as king was established and he had become strong, he and all Israel with him abandoned the law of the Lord because they had been unfaithful to the Lord. Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem in the fifth year of Rehoboam with 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen and innumerable troops from Libya, Sukkots, and Cushites that came from Egypt. He captured and fortified cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. Do make a note of that. Cushites were working with Shishak, because in a minute I'm going to mention the Cushites again. And there's an alliance between the Cushites and the Egyptians. So just note that, because it's going to come back up in a minute. So Shishak comes, and basically in and around this time period, he conquers over 150 cities. And when you get a close-up view on the wall that I showed you, like the big picture of, he's got all these different, these are different cities, different soldiers, and this hieroglyphic is a statement about which city he has attacked. And so there are many cities that he attacks up to Jerusalem and then south of there. And so what people have said is that there were a lot of like forts and fortified cities. And so as Shishak was attacking and trying to subjugate Judah, he went through all these cities and basically like conquered them. You know, broke down fortifications, forts, and really helped in, you know, in some ways crippling Judah for a time. And what also is fascinating about Shishak is that one of these cities that he conquered is Megiddo. And in Megiddo, this is they call it a victory still. And so when after he defeats Megiddo, they basically create a statue, and it's in honor of Shishak defeating them in battle. So wouldn't you like that if somebody came to your hometown and, you know, beat you up, and then after that built a monument so you'd always know that they beat you up? I wouldn't like that at all. But that's what happens here. And so there, again, it's hard to see, but if you look at the picture, you can see these different hieroglyphics, and they are celebrating, again, Shishak and his conquering of Megiddo. And so, again, more historical background for what happens when Shishak attacks Rehoboam in 2 Chronicles chapter 12. But it gives you more background about what's going on. He didn't just attack Jerusalem. He attacked 150 different cities. He conquered all of them, and he even left behind, you know, these monuments to himself. And so now we come to Asa. So Rehoboam has passed away. His son has passed away. And now we have Asa. And so Asa was a good king. He goes and he removes a lot of these bad things that are happening in the land. There's like temple prostitution type of worship, like paganism going on. And he goes and he, you know, gets rid of a lot of those things. So we kind of see a coming back to God during Asa's reign. And there are several kings who will make efforts, go, like all the way to like Josiah, really trying to bring the people back to God. And Asa is one of them. And so we like Asa, but we also see that Asa has some troubles. And he also has some troubles with Egypt. And so in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, 9 through 15, Zerah the Cushite marched out against them with a vast army and 300 chariots and came to Marisha. As Asa went out to meet him and took up battle position in the valley of Zarephath near Marisha. Then Asa called to the Lord his God and said, Lord, there is no one like you to help the powerless against the mighty. Help us, O Lord, our God, for we rely on you and in your name. We have come against this vast army. O Lord, you are our God. Do not let man prevail against us. And the Lord struck down the Cushites before Asa and Judah. The Cushites fled, and Asa and his army pursued them as far as Gera. Such a great number of Cushites fell that they could not recover. They were crushed before the Lord and his forces. The men of Judah carried off a large amount of plunder, and they destroyed villages. And so, in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, 9 through 15, Asa is attacked by a Cushite general named Zerah. Now, we just saw, you know, just a few years prior that there is an alliance between the Pharaoh and between the Cushites. This Pharaoh, Asorkon, that's pretty close. I need to go back and use some phonics on some of these names. This guy is Shishak's son. And this is what he looks like. And they still have this alliance. And so it is believed that this Pharaoh, who is the son of Shishak, called this attack against Judah. And of course, he rules from 922 to 887 BC. So there he is. And so we're still having a lot of fighting at this time with Egypt. But, you know, those things are going to continue happening because the people are not going to serve God. So he's going to continue to use nations to punish them. And so now we come to Joash. I think you can see this pretty well. And so this is a receipt of the donation of 3 shekels to the house of Yahweh, which is the Jerusalem temple. And it is dated between 835 and 801 BC, which is during the time of Joash. So again, we're kind of going back to this alphabet thing I was telling you about. I mean, this person gets a receipt for their donation in the temple. This is the time period, and it's, you know, it's got writing on it. You know, they could read. I mean, just another example of them being able to read. So there's not a lot of archaeological evidence in Joash's reign, but there is this that is dated to his time period. And so, you know, we can learn that you know, people were going to the temple, they were giving donations, and they were receiving receipts at that time, which I think is interesting. And then we have our next king we want to look at is Uzziah. And so there was a discovery of a seal or a bulla, and it says belonging to Abijah, or Abijah, again, phonics, servant of Uzziah. Now, I couldn't find the picture. I don't know if there's like an actual picture of it, but But this is the drawing of what it looked like. There is another discovery about Uzziah. And this says, hither were brought the bones of Uzziah, king of Judah, not to be opened. That's what that says. And then, this guy is Tiglath-Pileser III. And there is some writing that he does. There's discoveries that he has. And one of them says that 19 districts of the town Hamath, together with the towns in their circuit, which are situated on the coast of the Western Sea, which in their sin and wickedness sided with Azariah. Azariah is Uzziah. And I turned to the territory of Assyria. So I is Tiglath-Pileser III. He's referred to as Pul, P-U-L, in the Bible. And that we talked about that last week, but that was one of his titles that he took. P-U-L-L is Pul. So that is him. We're gonna encounter this guy a lot because he was a kind of like a warlord. What's that? Huh? Well, that is, I don't know if that's a Timex or, I think that's just like a vanity bracelet, you know, with a big gold piece on it. I don't mean, I hadn't noticed that, Jordan, thanks. Now I'm distracted. We need to zoom in on that and see if it's got a face. What's that? Yeah, I mean, maybe. Right. Maybe that's what it is. It's a sundial. Okay. So, okay. Let's try to get serious. Jotham is the next king. And this is a ring. A signet ring, and it was either owned by Jotham or it was owned by a seal bearer who could basically sign in the king's name. And what's interesting to me about this is that this piece is in the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. So most of these things are either in the British Museum or they're in the Historical Museum in Istanbul. There's some museums in Germany where a lot of the things about Nebuchadnezzar are located, but this one is actually in the United States. It's in Washington, D.C. So if you, I mean, I don't know if it's constantly on display or not, but you know, it's in the Natural History Museum there in Washington, D.C. if you want to look at that. So now we come to Ahaz, and I want to, you know, drill in a little bit on this because this stone tablet right here is the chronicles of Tiglath-Pileser III, and so there's a reference to Ahaz in here, but really I want to kind of dig in a little bit on this text. Just to kind of have an appreciation for what's going on and why these two came across each other. So in 2 Chronicles 28, 1 through 3, you have Ahaz. He's 20 years old when he became the king. He reigned in Jerusalem 16 years. Unlike David, his father, he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He walked in the ways of the king of Israel and also made idols for worshiping the Baals. He burned sacrifices in the valley of Ben-Hinnom and sacrificed his sons in the fire, following the detestable ways of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. That detestable ways, that should sound familiar to you because that is the god Molech, and that was the Ammonite god, and that was Solomon. And you know how you worship Molech? You worship Molech by sacrificing your kids. That's who we're talking about here. And the influence is still alive and well, even though some of these prior kings tried to do their best to get rid of it. So we've got the Valley of Ben-Hinnom. This is Ahaz. This is who he is. He's not a good guy. And so in verses 4 through 15, Judah is punished by God. There's fighting here that happens. If you go to like verse 6, in one day Pekah, son of Remaliah, killed 120,000 soldiers of Judah. Verse 7, Zerkah, an Ephraimite warrior, killed Manasseh's, the king's son, Azrakim, the officer in charge of the palace, and a few others. And the Israelites took captives from the kinsmen, 200,000 wives, sons, daughters. They also took a great deal of plunder, which they carried back to Samaria. And so we have a war that is going on between Judah and then Pekah, who is currently the king in Israel. In verses 16 through 21, Ahaz asks Tiglath-Pileser to help in this fighting. So in verse 16, at the time King Ahaz sent to the king of Assyria for help, the Edomites again had come and attacked Judah and carried away prisoners. While the Philistines had raided towns on the foothills in the Negev of Judah, they captured and occupied Beth Shemesh. Beth Shemesh should sound familiar to you because we've talked about Beth Shemesh already. And then a few other cities. Verse 19, the Lord had humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel, and he had promoted wickedness in Judah and had become most unfaithful to the Lord. Verse 20, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came to him, but he gave him trouble instead of help. Ahaz took some of the things from the temple of the Lord and from the royal palace and from the princes and presented them to the king of Assyria, but that did not help him. And so there's more that goes on, but we'll stop there. And so he asks Tiglath-Pileser for help. Ahaz ends up closing the temple and gives him a bunch of gold treasure from it. And then this has a statement about several different kings who gave tribute to Tiglath-Pileser, and one of them is Jehoahaz, which is Ahaz. That's some of these kings have like two different names. That's always confusing. But here we have a historical record that not only shows us that Ahaz knew Tiglath-Pileser, but this story where, you know, he's coming to help, but he doesn't help. He harms instead, and he takes tribute, and it's recorded in this stone. So there's a lot of historical on that. Go ahead, Mark.
When you look at the name Jehoahaz,
yeah.
Did you see Jehovah in that? Well, I'm not following that anymore.
Yeah.
Is that part of my name? I go by Ahaz.
Mm-hmm. Well, good point. I didn't think about. I mean, I can see Ahaz right here, but right. I mean, that's Jehovah and then Ahaz and. Point for Mark. That was good insight there. Yeah. I didn't even think about that, but I mean, to your point, I mean, he is just
close
the temple. Yeah. He doesn't want to have anything to do with God anymore. And so maybe that's why he's going just by Ahaz at this point. But there's the relationship and there's archaeological evidence that backs up everything that's stated here in 2 Chronicles 28. Another thing that we find in archaeology, again, this is the seal of King Ahaz. So it says belonging to Ahaz, king of Judah. So again, when he'd write letters, seal scrolls, you know, the wax, he'd press that down on the wax. It would come back with, you know, a seal and it would have this, you know, text on it. So they would know it, you know, this is from Ahaz, king of Judah. And so now we come to Hezekiah. Yay, Hezekiah. Hezekiah is a good king. Hezekiah is one of the best kings. I really like Hezekiah. I like Hezekiah and Josiah. Sometimes I like Hezekiah more than Josiah. Sometimes I like Josiah better than Hezekiah. But in my opinion, I mean, they're the best. I really like them. So Hezekiah, what do we find in archaeology about Hezekiah? So this is, again, it's his seal or call it a bulla. And so we found one of those that says, you know, it's from Hezekiah. There's also, this is a cup, and this is the handle on the cup, and that says belonging to the king And so this was found, and they believe that, I mean, this is Hezekiah's cup. Like it's his, from his stock. I'm sure he had a lot of cups, but this would be one of them. And that's that they know it because of this seal right here. What is also interesting about Hezekiah is, so he's going to be attacked by Sennacherib. Sennacherib, another king of Assyria, after Tiglath-Pileser the third. And when we go to 2 Chronicles chapter 32, verses 1 through 5, we read about some of the preparations that Hezekiah makes, because it seems like he knows this is coming. And so after all that Hezekiah had so faithfully done, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah. He laid siege to fortified cities, thinking to conquer them for himself. When Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come and that he intended to make war on Jerusalem, he consulted with his officers and military staff about blocking off the water from the springs outside the city, and they helped him. A large force of men assembled, and they blocked all the springs and the stream that flowed through the land. Why should the kings of Assyria come and find plenty of water, they said. Then he worked hard repairing all the broken sections of the wall, building towers on it, and built another wall outside with reinforcements supporting the terraces in the city of David. And he also made large weapons. And then there's more information here. But he's making preparations. And one of the preparations that he makes is that he creates, and they call it the Salome Tunnel. So this is the end of it right here. And so this was, they've got walls, and so what they're trying to do is come up with a way to get water inside the city while they are under siege. And this is the inside of that tunnel. And then here are some of the walls that Hezekiah like would have rebuilt during his time period in preparation for these attacks. And this is Sennacherib. Also has a nice beard. And then this is called the Taylor Prism because a guy named Taylor discovered it. But it's Sennacherib's prison. And so in this prism, one of the things that it talks about is that I shut up Hezekiah in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. And so just extra biblical evidence that Sennacherib did come to Jerusalem and he did besiege the city. It's interesting to note, though, that he doesn't say, I conquered Hezekiah, or I defeated Hezekiah, because he didn't. I mean, the biblical record would say he doesn't, and he doesn't necessarily say that. He says that he had them trapped, but you know, they left for some reason. Could have been because a lot of their soldiers died, which is what the Bible says. Now, this is from Sennacherib's temple, or not temple, his palace, and I think it's currently on display. Let me see where it's. Yeah, and this is currently on display in the British Museum. Now, I know that the coloring is just, I tried to change this a little bit, but you can kind of, if you came closer, or maybe you need to come closer, but there are archers here shooting arrows, and then right here, there is a battering ram, and there's a wall, and they're hitting the wall with a battering ram, and so they have besieged the city. There's a battering ram that they're trying to knock down the walls. And then there's also descriptions in the Bible about them building siege mounds. And there's some siege mounds in here as well. And so this is just a picture of the stuff that Sennacherib did when he was coming through Judah and conquering. And so according to the Bible, you know, he besieges, build up siege mounds. They did build up siege mounds. They did have like battering rams to try to knock down walls. And this is from his temple, or that's not his temple, his palace. So there's that. Now, another thing of note is that in 2 Kings, we learn how Sennacherib dies. Sennacherib is assassinated by his son in 2 Kings chapter 19 in verse 37.
One day, while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nerosh, his sons Adramelech and Sharezer cut him down with the sword, and they escaped to the land of Ararat in Asherhaddon. His son succeeded him as king. Now, this is, I'm not sure the source of this, other than it's historical record from Assyrian. I couldn't find like a picture of the inscription, but it says that they forsook the gods and turned to their deeds of violence, plotting evil to gain the kingship. They slew Sennacherib, their father. So this is a Assyrian reference that confirms what is said in the Bible about Sennacherib being assassinated. And then Ashurbanipal, he didn't take too kindly to the people killing his grandfather. And so he said he left some of the people alive by the Colossae, between which they cut down Sennacherib, the father of my father, who begot me. There's a lot more to this statement, and this statement is basically, I exacted revenge on the people who killed my grandfather. I think it's interesting to note, too, he doesn't say who his father is. It's his father killed his grandfather to take the throne. And, of course, he does the same thing, but he says it's in revenge. And so, again, historical evidence about Sennacherib. Hezekiah continued in 2 Kings chapter 20 and verse 12, and then there's also some passages in Isaiah that talk about this as well. But in 2 Kings chapter 20 and verse 12, and really before that, we read about Hezekiah being sick and that he's recovering. And what we understand is that Marduk-Baladan, we'll say, in 2 Kings chapter 20 and verse 12, sends an envoy, and he sent Hezekiah letters and a gift because he had heard of Hezekiah's illness. Hezekiah received the messengers and showed them all that was in his storehouses, the silver, the gold, the spices, and the fine oil, his armory, and everything found among his treasures. There was nothing in the palace or in all of his kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. Verse 14, then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and asked, what did those men say and where did they come from? From a distant land, Hezekiah replied, they came from Babylon. The prophet asked, what did they see in your palace? They saw everything in my palace, Hezekiah said. There was nothing among my treasures that I did not show them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all of your fathers have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. So this is Merodach. He's ruling in Babylon right now. But what's interesting is that there's some infighting going on between him and between the Assyrian Empire. And so there is some speculation as to the reason why he would have sent letters to Hezekiah. And the thought is that he wanted Hezekiah and him to create an alliance so that they could attack Assyria together. So there's a lot more going on than just him sending a gift. There's probably a reason for it, and the reason is he is fighting against the Assyrians. The Assyrians are trying to put him down. He has had to flee Babylon a few times. There are other people who have taken his place. They have failed, and so he's like back in charge now, and I think he's wanting some help potentially. There's another reference that I want to show you real quick in Isaiah chapter 25. Again, during the same time period, but Isaiah chapter 25, and then in verse 15. There is not a verse 15. Is there a verse? No, there's not. Why did I put 15? Maybe it's 5. There is a verse in Isaiah, and I will have to give you the reference because, once again, I have given you the wrong reference. But it refers to Shibna, the treasurer. This is from his tomb. Chapter 22, thank you. If I were a scribe, oh man, I lost my job a long time ago.
Thank you. I'm like, I don't know, is the verse right? Okay, this is what the Lord Almighty says, go say to this steward, to Shibna, who is in charge of the palace. And so there's just this reference to Shibna, and they have found this, and the archaeologists have found this inscription, and it refers to Shibna and him being the royal, what was he? He was the ruler over the house. He was the royal steward. That's what it says. So Shibna, this guy who's over the treasury, this guy's the royal steward. At same time period, uncommon name. So people, everybody believes that this Shibna, this in this inscription, is the person who is referred to in Isaiah. And so kind of we're almost out of time now, but just kind of going through these last few points. So in 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 11, we run across a person whose name's Nathan-Melech. This is a seal, and it's belonging to Nathan-Melech, servant of the king. So that's this guy, that's his seal. And he worked with Josiah. Pharaoh Necho is the person who ultimately kills Josiah in 2 Kings chapter 23, 29. And this is Pharaoh Necho. Jehoiachin Jehoiachin, he is captured by Nebuchadnezzar during the second captivity, which was in 597 BC. And he was ultimately released by this evil Merodach. This stone tablet refers to daily rations that were given to Jehoiachin and his family while they were staying in Babylon. So again, reference of a king being taken to Babylon and then later being released from Babylon. While he was in Babylon, he was being provided daily rations by the king. So it kind of completes the story for us. As he was under, their rule. You know, he was there, but you know they were providing daily rations for him. And then last, Gedaliah, who's ultimately he becomes the governor, and then he's assassinated pretty quickly thereafter. But we found another seal, and that's belonging to Gedaliah. And so that's a reference to him, and again, shortly after Jerusalem's fall, and the last one, so 587, 586 BC. And so that's all I have for today. Next week, we'll talk about, like I said, some of these attacks that happen. And then we'll get into those other historical books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther.